Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 3rd, 2006. Our session today is entitled Walking with Cancer Patients, Part 1. Our presenter is Tom Bracken. Session number BRT-2006-03. Let's listen in.
Well, should we get started? Good morning.
Morning.
I'm Tom Bracken, and this, for the Tate people, is Walking Through the Valley Together, helping our friends, family, and patients face cancer. A couple of disclaimers and claims. I'm a family physician, Central Minnesota. Some of you have been to my sex talks, which I'm even less qualified for. This is my third time in Holden. My experience with cancer is two things. One is my mother died of cancer. It's a little bit like being a pediatrician when you haven't had kids yet. You can have You can have some advice for them, but you really become a better teacher when you've had the kids and you've been up all night with them. But watching especially my dad go through and my family go through what happened with my mom dying from cancer 13 years ago got me more interested in it. I learned some things right away. And as a family doctor, I usually have about 12 patients a year that die from cancer, so about one a month. Some of those I'm involved with a lot, some of them I'm not involved with at all. And I'm still learning them. If I've learned one thing, it's that I have to keep learning about how to take care of them. So the goal of this hour is to look at our common experiences with cancer. I'll give some things, but I expect to take and for us to share about as much. And if we don't get through the material, that means we had a great hour. I kind of think we will. Oh, I forgot my book. There's a book, The Human, if anyone is interested in this, The Human Side of Cancer by Dr. Jimmy Holland. It's a female. She's a psychiatrist that works with dying cancer patients. Her husband's an oncologist down south somewhere. The Human Side of Cancer, I have it in the chalet. I'll bring it tomorrow. I should have it back tomorrow. And then at the end, we'll sing a song. Sometimes we'll listen to a song by U2, by Bono, whose dad died of cancer.
But everyone doesn't die of cancer.
That's a good point. And we'll talk a little bit more about that tomorrow. That's it. And why do you say that? Why don't you tell us what you're trying to get at?
I'm a cancer survivor. Mm-hmm. And everyone doesn't die of cancer. In your first diagnosis, you think you're so totally devastated, and you're sure you have yourself in the coffin right away. Everyone doesn't die of cancer.
Did you look at that possibility when you first found out you had cancer?
That maybe I first did. I had to have some help.
Yeah. You looked at the possibility of dying at some point?
Yes.
I mean, sometimes the very minor skin cancers or a little lump here or there, we don't worry too much, but we'll look at most of them. And that's one of the quotes we'll see today, is you very much look at that possibility.
How long ago was that?
I was 16 years.
I'm dealing with a cancer survivor now that's got quite a bit of guilt. He was a smoker. It's his fault that he had cancer, was the way he looked at it. And got a bunch of radiation, a bunch of chemo, some complications. He has some ongoing pain. He's still alive, and his wife is doing the work. She's driving the truck. So he's not working, and he's alive, and didn't want to, but he's all set up to die. It just didn't happen. Now you obviously are going to raise your hand. How many of you have had cancer, had somebody in your close family, or worked closely with somebody, a friend or someone that died of cancer? Anybody not?
They died of cancer.
Yeah. Or someone dying of cancer. It's really
strong. Or has it.
Or has it.
Or has it.
Yeah. It's like what Scott Peck talks about alcoholism. How many of you either are alcoholic or have a friend or family member with alcohol? Well, everybody. So everybody should go to Al-Anon. This is his answer. Everybody should be in 12-step. Kind of a neat concept. Please feel free to say whatever you feel like saying during this talk. Just a little bit, I didn't know how much people knew about cancer. We'll just define it very quickly. Tissue which grows without normal control. Subsequent growth causes invasion out of normal areas and may lead to distant spread. 1 out of 200 Americans are diagnosed with cancer each year. 25% of American deaths are from cancer. So it's a big issue. Why is this not an issue as much in the third world?
They die of other things.
Yeah, they die of trauma, malnutrition, infectious diseases. And why do we have so much cancer in America?
We're living longer.
It's mostly because we live longer. There's some environmental things. Somebody has asked me about that. We have more lung cancer. Some of our environment actually protects us from cancer. We don't get as much stomach cancer because of the way we treat food. But most of it's just because we live long enough that eventually something happens. I think, 50% of 85-year-old men have some prostate cancer. It doesn't bother them. But if you look hard enough, it's there. And actually, most of us probably have cancer in our life once, even if we die of something else. We've gotten it and fought it off. I told you a little bit about my terminal cancer patients. I became more attached to them after Mom died. Interestingly, my sister was here. That's all. I could give a long, hour-long talk on my sister coming to Holden because she was kind of estranged from my family. And she calls up and says, "Yeah, I'm going to come to Holden with you." Oh, good. Of course, you know what happened. We had a great time. But she was here, and she has some issues with how things went with Mom. But I cared about her from the beginning, and I remember as a third-year medical student, there was a kid at St. Paul Children's Hospital dying of some horrible thing, cancer, and the chart was just full of notes about blood pressures and blood tests. Nothing worked for her, and I couldn't find a note in the chart that talked about coping or spirituality or crying. There was things about pain and skin and things like that, but there was nothing in that entire chart about her struggle with cancer, her parents.
Is that how you approach some of your treatment with your patients? You approach it more of the spiritual side of looking at, especially in a terminal type of situation. Do you address that at all if they're open to it?
I do. It depends on the patient. One of the quotes in here is that people tend to die the way they live, and if they're really spiritual during their life, then they are on their dying. Not always. And other people that really it was never important to them, it's not like I'm saying, well, you know, you're going to die now, we better start talking about God. But it comes up with some of them. And I don't know if I'm more or less spiritual than my partners. The ones, you know, you see people that just treat people kind of as dogs. I mean, it's just like a vet. Well, here's what your blood counts is, and I'm going to give you this shot and that shot. And they don't get into those things. They run away from them. One of the books I read, Anatomy of Hope by Dr. I have his name on there somewhere. He worked for an oncologist who would let him moonlight while he was a fellow. And he realized that whenever the patient started to get to the point where they were terminal, the guy was gone when it was time for those rounds. He just didn't want to deal with it at all. So, yes, I do. I don't pray with patients very often. Maybe I should. What I do very often is get them in touch with their chaplain. We have this poor little lady. She's a cat lady. You know what cat ladies are? All they have in their house is cats. And she was blind. And she thought she had one cat because she only petted one at a time. She got about six. And she had had breast cancer for years and didn't do anything about it. And her own chest wall was just breast cancer. And she was bleeding from the spot. We just couldn't get it to stop. And this is just 2 weeks ago. And we sat and talked about some things. And the one thing I did for her was I got the priest in to see her. She hadn't been at Mass for a couple of years. She was weak and didn't feel well. The priest came in. That particular priest happens to be a person that really loves people. I'm sure he spent some time with her. And would come back and see her again, not just... Some of the priest stuff really irks me. It's mumbo-jumbo, get me out of here. The person's near death in a coma, and they do their whatever it is to them, and they don't talk to the family. Well, it's just... It's almost worse than nothing. The family's satisfied. You did that thing they have to have done, otherwise maybe they won't get to heaven.
No, I have to. My dear friend who was 96 died at Christmas of cancer, and all that mattered to her was having the priest come.
Yeah.
Even though she wasn't conscious anymore. Mm-hmm. Well, I think she was. To her, that mattered to have the last rites.
Well, I think that's important. But it's And that should be done, but that's part of it. Mm-hmm. It's also, in this case, the family was there and the priest should have been there. So. Yeah. Pardon me?
It's a need to talk to them, too.
Yeah. And our priest that we have at the I mean, he's just a wonderful man. He almost gave me communion at the funeral the other day. I don't know what he was thinking.
You never know.
Well, so do.
Well, he made a point that if you weren't Catholic, yeah, to fold your hands and you'd get a blessing. And I went up and I said, and he held out the host. He said, "Great, aren't you trying to give me a blessing?" Oh, yeah. So I don't know if he was feeling that he really wanted to share this with me, or was confused that I was up there, or...
He was thinking about this.
He got a blessing. We didn't even...
And I bet if he was here, he would take communion with us. And Father McNiff, who I also love, is 85, and he's quite the classicist. I bet he would not take communion here. He would enjoy the service. When we talk today, this is a little bit of a mixed-up talk, in that we're both talking as... Maybe some of us minister as doctors or nurses or chaplains or pastors. And maybe some of us have been there. What do you do?
Oh, I'm a physical therapy student.
There you go. So you're on this. And other times is what happens when we get there. So there's sometimes I'm going to go back and forth between patient and caregiver without bothering to explain it. So the first thing is the first news, and you talked a little. What's your name?
Edie
talked a little bit about it. How do you first learn it? Well, family doctor's office, most learn. Oncologist or surgery office. One lady last week said that she went in to get her biopsy report, and the physician, the doc, surgeon said, I think it was pretty good, and he was leafing through a chart. Oh, no, it was cancer. Yeah, we'll have to do some more. I think it was breast cancer she was talking about. She fired him.
Good.
And she told him, she had to talk with him. It sounded like she didn't just say, heck with you, and never saw him again. They actually talked about how that did not work for her. And this Dr. Groupman, who wrote the Anatomy of Hope, said he expects to be fired every so often. It's just such important stuff, and your style isn't going to fit for everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, a woman perhaps wants a woman doctor for her breast cancer. So, and we doctors hate that. Any of us caregivers just hate it. Well, you know, you're really not on the case anymore. I just keep, and in my small town, I see them then after that. One guy was talking about how he walked down the street and this guy would just glare at him because he had to explain that his PSA wasn't so high, he needed a biopsy, and he did have prostate cancer.
How do you feel when a patient argues with you?
Depends on the tenor of it. Often okay. There's some things I'm really right about. And I've been wrong sometimes when I'm really right about it. But especially, and where it's more often true is with the chemical and alcohol use. Oh, I don't really think I need any help. Then I'm a quiet, firm, repetitive voice. Yes, you do need help. Yes, you do need to go to treatment. And it depends if you have backup or not. Patients, when they get cancer, usually are saying, what do I need to do? Tell me. Whereas chemically dependent patients are usually, yeah, I know I got a problem I can handle. So it's a completely different mindset. And I use that cancer analogy with the chemically dependent people. It doesn't work.
Why do you hate it? Because you can't continue with treatment?
I hate the fact that they think they can do it on their own.
Okay.
The alcoholic patients always think they can.
I mean the cancer patients backing up. Isn't that what you said first?
I didn't say I hate anything with cancer patients. Sometimes I hate being elevated because I don't have all the answers and I'm not always right, and I don't like being called doctor all the time. Mm-hmm. In the community, it's not because I have some great sense of humility, because I do this with the doctors I see. Well, it's going to be your decision, and you know what's best for me, even though you have the same training I do. Mm-hmm. I saw my partner this year, who was a nice guy. He's a right winger. I trusted him with my body, though. And I really felt that sense of, well, you feel like this is okay, I'm not going to worry about it so much.
Well, I thought you did say that. You hated something, and I thought it was when you got fired.
Oh, yeah, I hate that. Oh, I hate that.
That's
what I absolutely
hate
that.
That's
oh, yeah.
What she
was asking. That's a blow to my ego.
Because of your, you think they think you're incompetent.
Yeah, I'm fearful I'm incompetent.
Oh. I needed to get fired, too.
Yeah. And there's times when, a lot of the times, most of the times I'm fired is not because I did something wrong. Oh. when I do something wrong, they love me. And, you know, and I have to feel guilty about they don't, they should, maybe you should fire me.
How are you going to say?
This is a bit off the subject.
Good.
But it's alcoholism, can alcoholism lead to liver cancer?
Yes. Alcoholism causes cirrhosis. Cirrhosis of any kind can cause liver cancer. A lot of the liver cancer we see is from hepatitis B and C, especially C. A lot of the Southeast Asian people come over and then they get a hepatoma, which is liver cancer, and die from that. And the sad thing is, I had a patient, this is another interesting story, patient that had abnormal liver tests and he had liver cancer and was incurable. And I really worked hard to see if we could get it removed and transplanted. So he went to Mayo, he went to the university where an old friend of mine is head of that department, and I really worked hard for him. And he had drank like 30 years ago and had cirrhosis, but hadn't drank at all. And so then he gets his liver cancer from the cirrhosis 30 years later. And he went through the usual stages and died. And I said, are you telling your wife that you're, you know, checking out and things aren't going? Yeah, she knows all about it. So after he died, his wife wanted to have an appointment with me, which is a good idea. But what she wanted to tell me was I didn't do near enough. Because I hadn't told him what to eat. If only I had told him what to eat and we had done something, we maybe could have fought this. And that, I had no doubt that I had really done some extra things for this guy. I had gotten stuff together and I walked downtown to hand it to him. I called the doctors elsewhere, but they didn't get answers. And I really tried to help him and cared about him. So my reward was, you didn't do enough. That, now I had, didn't feel guilty about not doing enough, and that felt really bad.
Because of her perception.
Yeah.
Well, one of the family members said something, yeah, I'm sorry you have to deal with her. And she's just that way. So I was really glad that she went away. And sometimes you learn about it in a bad way. You get an email or you get a letter. Some of the tips for the caregivers is to be sure you have enough time and you have the right people there. You know, that requires some planning. Sometimes I send people off for something I think is routine and here's this horrible thing on the CT or the chest x-ray. Yeah, I was just thinking you should come in and I think your test results are coming in tomorrow and then we can talk about them together. They usually know by the time they get there that I got something to say. It's hard to lie about that. I don't lie as a general rule, and I do lie about that. Did you hear the Madden's this morning about the hostage situation? The guy's taken hostage, and the guy says, I'm going to kill your family unless you say you don't believe in God and renounce him. And he doesn't renounce his God, so he kills his whole family. And so the man doing the talk says, you should renounce God, he can handle it. Mm-hmm. God cares more about your family than being insulted. Mm-hmm. So it's really important to have plenty of time and the right people. One thing I often do is write out the information, because they won't hear much of what you say after you hear the word cancer. I think the last time you heard bad news, you've all heard bad news. 9/11, day 9/11 happened, we were in a meeting, and then I had to go do a procedure on somebody. And life had to go on. It didn't stop. It was a horrible day, and everybody was so upset. So I write it down. I write a lot of things for patients. One of the few great accomplishments I made in life is I got us all tablets with our doctor name at the top and phone numbers. I'm supposed to bring it into the room so you write things out rather than just tell them. I'll listen to people talking to other patients sometimes and all this stuff. And patients, and they don't even understand a lot of the words. My partners are mostly better than that, but not all.
My dad was telling me about something he got written down for him on a prescription. Stay in a well-lit room and use a cane.
Oh.
He wasn't feeling well.
Yeah.
Well, his doctor just wouldn't. Yeah, I mean, he doesn't use a cane.
Oh.
Found out later it was kidney failure, but this doctor would not listen to him.
Wow.
That's what he was. He got a second opinion.
Yeah.
But I mean, stay in a well-lit room and use a cane. But it was written on a prescription, yeah, so it was.
Oftentimes you can't read what they write anyhow.
I think that's a real key point for the medical people to understand that they talk in a foreign language. And common folks don't understand a lot of what they say.
Yep.
My wife is a medical technologist and she can go to the hospital and understand what's going on. But I go in and it's not engineering, so I don't understand it.
When my mom was diagnosed, my dad heard she had metastatic disease, which is it doesn't mean anything. He didn't hear it. He knew it was bad. I heard it, and I thought it meant metastatic, which means the cancer has spread. And my world went from, yeah, mom and dad live down there, and we go there on Christmas, to, oh, my life's never going to be the same. And a lot of conflicting emotions. Don't give too much information. It's too much to cope with. Some basic, simple things. And if a woman has breast cancer, you know, we usually talk about what her options are. I don't get into some of the new chemotherapy agents and what percentage of women get heart failure and all that kind of stuff. We just talk about, you know, you might have to have this. And I'm usually minimizing the side effects. It's not going to be that bad. Most women do fine, which they do. So I go through that initial plan. They need to have basic options, which next, what choices need to be made soon, not all the choices. This is a little bit about what Edie talked about, coping with a cancer diagnosis. The diagnosis changes everything. It's a fairly major diagnosis. We had an interesting event in Omania. The lumberyard's right across the street from the hospital. And I woke up, I was overnight, and it was smoky, and the lumberyard was on fire. We had quite a crisis because a building like that has air intake, and it was very full of smoke. And we had to cope with that. But, so the lumberyard owners had, they lost their life's work. It all went off in smoke. Well, they also had tax problems. They hadn't been paying their taxes for 2 years. And the newspaper was due to put an article in the paper that they had tax problems, they weren't supposed to be doing business, and their business goes up. What's your first thought?
Arson.
And my good friend, who I climbed the hills out here with Holden, owns the paper. He run those articles. So it was very emotional. The next week, everybody in town knows this, or I wouldn't talk about it even here. She finds out she has breast cancer. Well, that's kind of like kicking a dog when you're down, very much so. But it also helped them cope with the first problem. Why did it help them do that?
Yes, breast cancer was worse.
It was worse. If we can get through that, put things in focus, who cares? Who cares if we can go to jail? I don't think they will, but they've got each other. If we can get her through this, and they just focused on that, and the community too. But it changes everything. And the thought that you mentioned, I could die from this. We all think of that when we get a little ache somewhere, don't you? When you're over about 30. If you're a medical student, you do it all through med school. I had osteosarcoma, and I had melanoma, which was just a little blood blister. This year it was pain up in here. I still don't know what that was. I had a CAT scan. You know what CAT scans cost?
Yes.
About $2,000. And with our new insurances, it came out of my pocket. So CAT scan, blood test, and exam was $3,000.
What was it?
Nothing.
This whole wallet.
It was musculoskeletal. And my wise old mentor doctor that I work with occasionally said, yes, it's muscle.
Even more so after you've had cancer, because you tend to say, oh my gosh, I've got stomach cancer. Forgetting you had pizza once. Yeah. Or something like that. Well, every ache and pain, you tend to say, this is sneaking up on me again.
Except for him, we're all over 40, and I think. Am I getting anybody in trouble?
No.
And the aches and pains last longer, don't they?
That's the same after you've had a heart attack. It's like, yeah, here it is again.
Now, how you cope with it does change your treatment. In that people that are just totally overwhelmed can't go through it. They just can't handle things. And other people that are coping fairly well, honestly and openly, they do a little better. But you as a physician or family can help them. Some of the stages of adjustment, these are really similar to the death and dying stages. We used to, and I think Elizabeth Kubler-Ross did us all a favor by describing those. But we don't need to be fundamentalists about it. I don't see them clearly in order. Sometimes I do.
was it denial? It's the same as denial we see. How could I possibly have this? No, that's nothing. I'm just believable. I see that occasionally. You know, you really ought to think about having something done about this.
Do you see anger?
Oh, yeah, anger at God. Anger at themselves. At
I had anger, but not at God. I just didn't want to play in that ball
game.
Yeah. I didn't want to be in that ball game. Leave me alone. I was fine when I walked in here.
Yeah.
I was very angry.
And Dr. Collin describes turmoil, restlessness, helplessness, preoccupation, feel like you're losing your mind. And whatever stress patterns you've had, Adlerian psychology says that how we react to stress is how we react when we were four. So if you really felt alone when you were four because your dad left your mom, or if you got violent, whatever you did when you were four is what happens. You feel like a four-year-old. And then finally, you move on, hopefully, and move on to treatment. So what kind of attitude does your loved one bring? Well, my mom, I love my mom. And she was the good girl in the family while Dad was at war, and the other kids were bad, but she was a good girl. And she was afraid of everything and had panic disorder the last 2-3 years of her life. And so you'd expect her to panic and not deal with it, and interestingly, her panic disorder went away. And she wasn't anxious anymore. Mm-hmm. You see that sometimes with panicky people. Well, now I got something to really worry about. I don't have to worry about these ethereal things. I can focus on this, and I don't have to worry about global warming or whatever it is. And she quit smoking. She had terminal cancer, and she quit smoking. She's very proud of that. So you don't know. You can look at what attitude they bring. And some of my patients get cancer. Oh, my gosh, please, somebody else. I can't stand the thought of even seeing this person once a week. They're just not going to do well. And they surprise you. We have this little guy who looks like a gargoyle. Retarded man that lived in town, and he sat on the edge of the smoking all day, talking, yeah, dumb damn woman, and she bitter. He got cancer. He was the sweetest, lovingest man. So easy to deal. It was just a blessing to be there for him. But you can't change your personality, as we mentioned. It often revives your previous patterns of reacting to stress. Dr. Holland talked about 3 myths that you wanted cancer. I don't see that. But she thought she had seen a lot of patients that thought maybe this is my fault. I think this is more, we think we brought things on. This is my fault. Or that your problems cause cancer, your psychological problems, stress. Now, tobacco does cause cancer. I see people both that really feel guilty or else feel resigned or else dismiss it. And this is the worst one. Your negative attitude is feeding your cancer. It's aiding your cancer. And we're going to
get there
today. Yeah, this is coming up.
Can't the opposite of that be true, though?
How's that?
Positive attitude help in surviving?
It helps with treatment and with the normal kinds of things. Does it help the cancer as far as your white cells are stronger? I'm going to talk about that in a minute, that it probably doesn't.
This is a fly.
Like James. The fly? The fly.
I need a toque.
That's not a bad thing. The fly picks people. I've been in this room for several times. It goes from one person to another, and I think it's sin or something.
Hey.
You wanted that. You wanted that. Talk about coping. Well, factors that aid coping and positive attitude do aid. That does aid coping. You'll be refreshed. You'll be there. You'll think. You'll say, well, I'll try that. A negative attitude, well, nothing's going to work anyway. It doesn't help. And these are just the people that cope better, and it doesn't bog them down as much, and they live what life they have left. If you've read Tuesdays with Maury, what a great attitude he had. We'll have a quote from him later. He continued to live his life. Other people just give up and don't do anything. And one thing cancer patients do a little off the subject is that when it's time to die, they stop eating, which is not suicide, but it's also not sustaining life. and Timothy Quill, who's a kind of notorious end-of-life person, described that in some people out in panic as they were tomorrow, that they'll often just stop taking nourishment, which is completely okay.
Doesn't that occur in a lot of aged people? They get to the point where they're ready to quit fighting?
I had a patient that had terrible pancreas cancer, and he had a pump. He was given a tremendous amount of morphine today, the most I've ever seen. And his wife, who was real nag, kept bugging him to eat. Oh, you gotta eat, you gotta eat, you gotta eat. He couldn't eat. He just felt miserable. It made him feel worse to eat. And he said, "Doctor, would you talk to her? Because I don't mind that she nags me. I don't consider it nagging, but it must be awfully tiring for her to have to tell me that all day." And I just can't. Such a wonderful
one.
But isn't that part of the dying process, too? I mean, like my dog stopped eating before.
Yeah. And what do? They go out by themselves. They don't always want everybody there. I wish I could be a day at a time person. I am out here. I'm not at home.
Sometimes that's all you can do, though. My brother-in-law is going through it, and my sister, I'd kind of like to do something with her on the 14th of August, and she said, you know, I might have to be out driving a truck in the field. She said, I can only go one day.
If you meet a crisis head-on as opposed to avoiding all challenges, that's a good attitude. If you're not real stressed or overly stressed. And then information. It's easier if you have the information out. People sometimes say, I don't want too much information. But when you don't know what you're heading for and you don't understand what's going on, I'm amazed at how little cancer patients ask me. Now, you do get the people with a list of 20 questions and, well, I read this on the internet and they know more about some side effect of the medicine than I did, which is okay, that's good. And maybe I'm not the right person to ask the questions, maybe an oncologist is. Supportive doctor and team as opposed to unsupportive doctor and team. Well, that's pretty obvious. I had a patient going to a doctor that just didn't tell her anything and she didn't like him, and I sent her to my friend who was a wonderful young oncologist, just so giving and caring, man of faith. First man was too. But she said, well, we'll have to see what the first doctor says about it. It's a waste of time. Supportive family and friends. Faith? Well, people of faith do better coping with hard things, depending on what their faith is in. If your faith is that God will never let you die, or that there's going to be a miracle, or that good people don't get into trouble. Our nurse care coordinator is basically an atheist, and she asked me, why do you Christians work so hard to keep people that are obviously dying from going to the next life, which is true. We shouldn't, and we don't. We're much better at not giving IV fluids and doing sustaining things to people that are obviously on their way out. Sometimes the bigger centers, teaching centers, don't even think about, should we feed this person? What's left? You know, they've had a good life, they've been going like this, they're going to do this. Do we really want to do this? Do we want to move it a month or two this side? And counseling, or at least talking. The pastor, the doctor, their friend, their family.
Support
groups are good cancer support groups. In some, we have a tiny community, so we don't have that. How's the fly?
This is over here a lot.
Thank you. It's interesting, there was a man from our congregation who was dying of cancer, and he said, finally he had talked, and he said, you know, Pastor Lori, I've never been a very religious man. And I said, I know that, and I'm real thankful that you're not. I said, religious people make me nervous. And he kind of looked at me like, what's this about? And I said, but what I see before me on this bed is a real faithful man. And that's what it's about. And he started to cry, and I said, that's who I know he is.
I understand that better today than I would have 2 weeks ago.
You know, and we had a good conversation about his faith. Mm-hmm. And he said, this is the first time in my whole life that I've known that I was faithful. Mm-hmm. And it's at those times that you can sometimes have those conversations. And I think that he died knowing that he was a faithful man, you know. But it wasn't about him being religious. And I think you've got to be bold enough to have those conversations with
him. That's a, that was great. It's great that you were there with him.
Because everyone doesn't do that.
Some studies have suggested that patients with positive attitudes have improved survival rates. Therefore, it's imperative to have a positive attitude or you will die. How hard is that? And I've seen this written in literature that's handed out to cancer patients and other patients. Some scripture says to believe you will receive what you pray for as if you already received it. So if you falter in your faith, you will die. And on the other hand, if you haven't gotten it yet, your faith isn't any good. I love this fundamental thing that if you're not getting what you prayed for, you have not confessed sin.
Jeez.
And I've heard that told to patients when they're not being healed. I like that about as much as I like when somebody dies tragically, God wanted her more than we did, or needed her more than we did. My partner, his mother died when he was 12, which completely changed his whole life. And they said that at the funeral, God needed her more than you did. And it really took him out of the faith community for a long time. It changed his whole personality.
What kind of God is that?
So some myths you want to can't. We already, this was, I put this in twice. There's an article in the Minneapolis Star Tribune about, and it was written by a Baptist preacher about, if you get cancer, it's very important to realize this is a gift from God. And how you could use that. That's not Romans 8:28. Romans 8:28, you could probably quote it. The gist of it is, God does good in all things. Good can come from it. But don't take this as the latest gift from God. This is not a blessing. This is a, there are bad things. So the truth about this is, studies that showed a positive attitude made a difference biologically were pretty weak effects at most and not very reproducible. Patients with more attitudes likely had less worrisome disease. Now, cancer tissue is tissue that doesn't respond to your body anyway. That's the whole problem. It's not responding to hormones and the usual control, so why would it respond to a positive attitude? And if a bad attitude or a sad, stressed attitude makes you die, how come grieving people don't have increased rates of death? They don't, except for suicide and things like that. But it does show that good support helps people live a little longer and to live better. They cope with their cancer better. So some ideas with attitude. You can help yourself by having healthy habits. Don't blame yourself. Negativity didn't cause your cancer. Otherwise, I'd be dead. Decide what you believe. As regard your faith system, and consider your tenderness carefully. Using a coping style that works for you. If it doesn't work, get help. And support groups are very helpful. They're not always needed. I killed something at home and I feel terrible.
God will strike me.
Jay and I were in the hot tub yesterday. A fly was in there and I very carefully rescued it. Oh. Put it out, dried it out, and I had to do a mercy killing.
Confession.
It had a leg that wasn't working, so.
Oh my God.
Did you guys go to Bible study today? She was talking about, I said the comment about the bear.
Yes.
And we were all talking about the fawns and the deer. They're so beautiful and gentle. I watched, there was those probably the same fawns and two does. And the fawns were being approached by both does, and the does fought.
Oh, cool.
And their hind legs, and I had to get out of the way because they were up on their hind legs pawing at each other.
Oh my gosh.
And I think the other point of Job is that this world is dangerous. And bears, I don't like them. I'm not very worried about them, but I ran by that. I saw the baby come across, and I thought, is that a naughty bear going away from its mommy, or a good bear going to its mommy?
Either way,
I was out jogging, and I was between me and the village. So I walked by, and I walked by her before I saw her. She's about 15 feet from me looking. Who the heck are you? And I talked to her and got out of here, but I'm not jogging down there in the morning. So the key is to connect with a doctor, caregiver, with whom you can talk comfortably and honestly. That's the first key. And people really should check out. We just don't have that many options in my town. We have one oncologist. He's a good doctor. He's a caring person. He's not real professional. He doesn't wear a tie to work. Not everybody likes that. And his wife is dying of cancer. He's just in his 40s and his 50s, and his wife is dying. And not everybody feels good with him, so we have sent him somewhere else. We have one surgeon. If you don't like her, it's hard.
My doctor wears Levi's and cowboy boots.
Well, that's okay if you're comfortable with it. Is everybody? Where do you live?
Southern California.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
I'm sorry.
What did you say?
Southern California. My doctor wears Levi's and cowboy boots. But yeah, it's fine with me. Maybe there's some.
If they're comfortable, like
wouldn't it. Accept that too well.
What does the clothes have to do with it?
It doesn't have a lot. Some people get a first impression. The oncologist, you're in turmoil, and you walk in, and here he is. You're thinking, what's he going to be like?
Well, yeah, but...
You know? Well,
it's
not the most important thing.
No.
Or what if you know he's gay, and you happen to be homophobic? Hmm. You know, that could be a problem. Our pediatric cardiologist, who is just a gem, he's just wonderful, and he's gay. And he's black in our community. We do not have a lot of black people. We have two black doctors and almost no black community members. There are a lot of Native American. It's just not a group that's been in our community. And I've been surprised how well they work with the urologists. They just kind of don't see it after a while. But still, it's first impressions, and you have some people that are pretty prejudiced too. So it's sometimes I'm not saying that's what you should change your mind for, but it's often other things. They won't talk to you. Or don't worry about that. Or they're authoritative. Some people want authoritative. When I first came, it didn't work very well because I wasn't authoritative like the guy before me. Coping is always easier when you have someone who faces your fears with you, your doctor, your family, friends, pastor, and God. I don't think God's enough. It helps if you have strong faith and you really have that sense of God with you. But I think you need other people too.
I think that's where we're called to be, the hands and feet of God.
Yeah. When my mom became ill, she went through chemo and stuff, and things were just kind of going this direction. They weren't doing this yet. And they started doing this. And my dad didn't know what to do. Well, his son, the doctor, lives an hour away. He didn't call me. He didn't know about home care. He thought to talk to his doctor, and it is a little odd in the Twin Cities, that he had to see him on rounds at 6 in the morning. His doctor knew I was a physician and never talked to me. You know, when I find out people have physicians in their family and say, well, could I call them? Or could I sit down with them? Would they like to know about this? That's really where my being interested in this came from, was the fact that my dad didn't feel like he had any resources. He did, but he didn't know how to access them, and he didn't ask for help. And so he had two miserable days. How am I going to cope with my wife who was sick and not able to get up much? And, well, finally he just had a crisis, called the ambulance. She was in the hospital and it was taken care of, you know. But the point was, he didn't have anybody to call. And I... Go ahead.
Some people have never asked for help in their life and they don't know how to ask for help.
That's a good point.
And if they've been an authoritative person or very strong in their work or whatever, they don't know how to ask for help.
Or accept it.
Right. Or accept it. That's also very difficult.
And that's the way he was. And interesting thing is, he went from a person that could cope with anything to a person that couldn't cope with anything. Mm-hmm. And just the little things now are, I'm not sure if I'll be able to do that. Mm-hmm. I give my phone number to patients. We're not listed in the phone book. The dying patients, the cancer patients, all get it. They probably use it once every 3 months. And it's not that I say I'll come in and take care of everything, but I know your case. Mm-hmm. And I can explain it to the persons that's there. And sometimes I do come in if it's something that I really feel like they need to be there for. One other problem he had is that the doctors in the cities don't do rounds every day, and so somebody would come in and didn't really know what's going on. But I know what's going on with you, and we do our own runs in the hospital, so we're there every day for them.
Do you find the difference in the age of the patient too? Like, for instance, my father never wanted to bother the doctor.
Yeah.
He just didn't want to bother
him. That's Paul Wilson's dad is my patient. And a couple times I came in the room and he'd been waiting 10 minutes. He said, you know, I think you're way too busy for me. I'll just, it might sound that important. I'll come back. No, you're paying the same as everybody else. What were you going to say?
Yeah. What is the relationship between your family doctor and an oncologist? Are they a team? Do they work together?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Good question.
Well, okay, in my practice there are 6 doctors, 4 PAs, 1 oncologist that comes once a month from a different town, and then a lot of our patients go to a different town, which is bigger. So the oncologist comes from medium town, and we get the big town that has everything. And the oncologist and I work together quite a bit because I happen to I've been there the longest, have the oldest patients. So we do work as a team, although sometimes he'll kind of do stuff and not tell me. And I think doctors have lost a lot of their common courtesy. When my cancer patients die, I send a letter to the oncologist, thank you for seeing them, they really appreciated you, even if they didn't. And if the surgeon operated on them, I let them know what happened. Now, I don't always get the other side of it. If my patients go to a far place, the University of Minnesota's the worst. They go down there, they never call me. They send me a letter that they were admitted, that was it. And I may or may not get something. I can call down there and complain and not get something. So it's not a team, which does not help. And I haven't seen a lot written about this. I guess, of course, I don't have access to a good medical library, so I don't know how much there is. But and some of my partners are content to just send them on, and they're glad to see him when they come back. A lot of times what happens is we diagnose it, we find the bad thing, we send him off to some big center that works on him. They work on him until they fail, patient fails, and then they come back to us to die. And in the Twin Cities, I think more often that happens that the oncologists take over care, and they do the dying. We do a lot more dying work in our little community than a family doctor in the Twin Cities. Who's dying?
Oh, me. I'm sick. It was me. I don't know why.
So it's even a different relationship for me to talk to the Twin Cities doctors than I think some of the family practice doctors in the Twin Cities, because we're so close to our patients just because we're in a small community.
Are there cancer cases that you don't need to refer to
the
oncologist?
Oh, yeah. Anything else? And this kind of fit with the theme. I'm always thinking, that's the theme, right? The holding theme of the summer. An important thing, this came up, Norm Maling talking about the strengths of communities last night. Look for what strengths you and your family already have. He talked about a man that redeems communities by going to them and finding out what they have. Well, we got a really good ice cream truck. Great, we'll work with that. Let's get him in here. And I don't know much about this, but I thought that was a great way to start. What strengths do you have? Our church has really good music and worship. Good, we'll work with that. We got some other big gaps. So you have to help them solidify their support system. And when I see people that are kind of estranged from family, I had one man, that little old guy that lives in the motel that nobody really knows who he is, and you see him reading papers around town. Well, he got prostate cancer, and it was obviously terminal. Kept his stuff in an RV he had parked outside. And he wouldn't let us call his family until he died. He was kind of quiet. But he did okay. He died in the nursing home. We helped him out. Now for patients, these are some ideas. Identify your problems. Patients come in with those written questions. They think, I'm really sorry. Well, I thank them for them. Sometimes internally you kind of, okay, this is going to take a while. Keep a medical notebook, cancer journal. It's really important for complicated things. Transplant patients all have their notebooks they carry around. More of us should be doing that. And someday there'll probably be a chip that has all your stuff on it. Then they're going to want to implant it. And the mark of the beast is going to be talked about at great length. Decide how much information you want and how much of a partnership you want.
Some people want the authoritative, tell me what to do. Other people, no, I'm hiring you. I'm paying you. I'm going to get my money's worth. I need some water here.
I'm going to get some flies and bring them back.
It's good to have a medical companion come with you if you don't understand things.
Especially older people, too. They tend to forget what they just heard. My wife used to go with my aunt to see the doctor. My wife got a lot of information that was useful later on that my aunt just didn't remember.
I got a 97-year-old gentleman that's been ill. He has a cancer, and it was, I think, a curable one. His son was gone, we couldn't find him, and I had to, can I talk to this other man in the church that he does things with? 75-year-old guy, young guy. And you can tell him, because I just had to have somebody to talk to. It just couldn't be him and me. Partly because what if he dies? You know, what am I going to do? And second opinions are fine. Often people get second and third opinions and then come back to the first one.
This is a little bit off topic, I guess, but I'm just curious if you run into a problem with time issues. I know that physicians often don't have a lot of time depending on scheduling with the amount of patients that are coming in to spend that amount of time, especially when you have a diagnosis that requires an additional amount of information. Does time become an issue for you to, you know, get that information out? And then you've got somebody who maybe doesn't understand that. Can you sense that and take that extra bit of time that's really necessary to provide the level of care that they need?
It's a terrible problem. I mean, our main goal when we see patients like you is to get out of there. Get in and get out, because you got, it's not so much that you're trying to rack up the money, you just got that much work to do. And you get used to doing things too fast. Our oncologists will often spend an hour with people, you know, a new case, and talking about things, and that's great.
Yeah, that's good.
But he's dealing with one thing, and he doesn't have an emergency room and babies and calls and all this stuff. So, and sometimes you have to say, let's do you at the end of the day tomorrow, and we can just go as long as you want. And you also have to realize it's very important. It's more important than blood pressure. It's like when your kids come home and they say, Mom and Dad, I want to talk. Well, that's an emergency. That's more important than a book club. It doesn't happen very often.
That's the difference between 60.
I already talked about that. It's really important to get family members involved. You just have to ask patients, can I call your kids? Or can your kids call? Is it okay? If they call me, can I talk to you? Usually it is. And sometimes you'll have some nice female Lutheran pastor says, you know, things aren't so good with my kids. No, you can't. Then you know that. That's the main stuff I have. The time is going pretty good. What else do you have for me before we listen to some music?
I actually have a lot because I'm trained as a hospice volunteer. Mm-hmm. And so we receive training in grief management. And our not patients have a terminal diagnosis that live less than 6 months. And so I just want to say a couple things. One is after the person dies, or even while they're dying, I'm sorry, in their family and caregivers, everyone grieves their own way. So perhaps the lady.
Nobody ever does what?
Everyone grieves differently.
Oh.
So perhaps the lady who was coming in and saying, you failed my husband, some of them were just angry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I failed that, not you. Mm-hmm.
She needed somebody, you needed to.
You were just in her way.
Yeah.
And so don't expect yourself to grieve like you're doing it the wrong way or anything. You're grieving the way you have to. Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask you about how many hospitals you know of that have a palliative care system or section. There's not enough, seems like.
I know I have a couple people I can call. There's one in, a couple in the Minneapolis area, and one is just this kindly old guy, he's an oncologist, that's all he does.
Yeah.
And we have pain centers too. I mean, just the pain is a big issue, just the technical aspects. Mm-hmm. Even then, I get to places where it looks like a road without. What's the word I'm looking for? Dead end road. What am I going to do? I don't know what to do.
And nobody.
Yeah. As a doctor, I don't know what to do. I have a guy with bladder cancer who needs an epidural catheter and keep his pain control. And where is he going to go? How is he going to cope with it? And it's really hard.
Yeah.
sometimes you just feel like you don't have that helplessness feeling I feel.
Well, in our experience, a lot of doctors say, well, it's terminally, they close the file and say they're on their own, but they still need, they're suffering from so much pain, they still need treatment. And
I tell them, the people that I know that are in that, for instance, colon cancer with spread in the liver, I say I'm going to see you every month.
Good.
And we maybe don't do anything. Yeah. One guy I did that to, he had the pancreas cancer. He walked out, and his wife said, well, what did he say? Well, I guess it's not too good. Why? Well, he didn't tell me to come back. I just forgot. His way of coping was to do obscene jigsaw puzzles. He had these jigsaw puzzles with little drawings of dirty people on them.
That's hilarious.
And well, he gave me the puzzles when he died.
Did you give him the paper?
I threw them away.
Oh, they really
did. I accepted it, but I threw them away.
I have one more thing I wanted to say. One, we had this packet this big of what we studied, but they included a book called Final Gifts. And
all somebody else talked about that. I got
it. It's a wonderful.
I've given it to several friends whose parents were dying of cancer, and they've all said it's made such a huge difference. It's how the survivors understand the process the person who's dying is going through. And they said it's been indispensable. So I just wanted to recommend that.
The book Kitchen Table Wisdom, which is written by a Jewish woman, is in the gift store. It's really good too.
She's got a second one.
Grandfather's
Blessings.
It's called
Grandfather's Blessings.
And Kitchen Table Wisdom?
Yeah, Kitchen Table Wisdom.
Yeah, it's in the bookstore. Any other things?
Final Gifts of Spirit.
Should we listen to a song by Bono?
Sure.
Bono, you know who Bono is? Everybody know who Bono is? You know who Bono is?
Yeah.
That's very impressive. You don't own any of his albums, though, do you?
There is a limit, huh?
This, their latest, U2's latest album, I think just about anybody can listen to. The first song is so rock and roll, and a couple of them are, but it's just a great album.
And so he lost his father again?
His father, I think, had lung cancer, if I'm not mistaken. And he wrote this song about it.
Thank you.
that song probably 60 times.
I think it's just absolutely beautiful.
What's the name of the album?
How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb. It doesn't talk about how do you dismantle an atomic bomb besides taking it apart.
Blow it up?
Loving me. That's what the album's about. It doesn't ever talk about atomic bombs. It's quite an interesting album. This song won a Grammy Award, I think, for the best vocal. Well, we're done officially. Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks for sharing.
Thank you.
Especially the song.
Isn't that a great song?
By the
Thanks. Good stuff.
Yeah.